Chapter 56. 3 days rain, an exceptional phenomenon in Rome during summer, and hail falling in opposition to the natural order, not only in the day, but even at night, interrupted the spectacles. People were growing alarmed. A failure of grapes was predicted, and when on a certain afternoon a thunderbolt melted the bronze statue of Ceres on the Capitol, sacrifices were ordered in the temple of Jupiter Salvator. The priests of Ceres spread a report that the anger of the gods was turned on the city because of the too hasty punishment of Christians. Hence crowds began to insist that the spectacles be given without reference to weather. Delight seized all Rome when the announcement was made at last that the ludus would begin again after 3 days' interval. Meanwhile, beautiful weather returned. The amphitheater was filled at daybreak with thousands of people. Caesar came early with the Vestals and the court. The spectacle was to begin with a battle among the Christians, who to this end were arrayed as gladiators, and furnished with all kinds of weapons which served gladiators by profession in offensive and defensive struggles. But here came disappointment. The Christians threw nets, darts, tridents, and swords on the arena, embraced and encouraged one another to endurance in view of torture and death. At this, deep indignation and resentment seized the hearts of the multitude. Some reproached the Christiaeus with cowardice and pusillanimity. Others asserted that they refused to fight through hatred of the people, so as to deprive them of that pleasure which the sight of bravery produces. Finally, at command of Caesar, real gladiators were led out, who dispatched in one twinkle the kneeling and defenseless victims. When these bodies were removed, the spectacle was a series of mythologic pictures, Caesar's own idea. The audience saw Hercules blazing in living fire on Mount Etna. Vinicius had trembled at the thought that the role of Hercules might be intended for Ursus, but evidently the turn of Lygia's faithful servant had not come, for on the pile some other Christian was burning, a man quite unknown to Vinicius. In the next picture, Shiloh, whom Caesar would not excuse from attendance, saw acquaintances. The death of Daedalus was represented, and also that of Icarus. In the role of Daedalus appeared Eurystheus, that old man who had given Shiloh the sign of the fish. The role of Icarus was taken by his son, Quartus. Both were raised aloft with cunning machinery, and then hurled suddenly from an immense height to the arena. Young Quartus fell so near Caesar's podium that he spattered with blood not only the external ornaments, but the purple covering spread over the front of the podium. Shiloh did not see the fall, for he closed his eaves, but he heard the dull thump of the body, and when after a time he saw blood there close to him, he came near fainting a second time. The pictures changed quickly. The shameful torments of maidens violated before death by gladiators dressed as wild beasts delighted the hearts of the rabble. They saw priestesses of Cybele and Ceres, they saw the Danaids, they saw Dirce and Pasiphae. Finally they saw young girls, not mature yet, torn asunder by wild horses. Every moment the crowd applauded new ideas of Nero, who, proud of them, and made happy by plaudits, did not take the emerald from his eye for one instant, while looking at white bodies torn with iron, and the convulsive quivering of victims. Pictures were given also from the history of the city. After the maidens they saw Mucius Scaevola, whose hand fastened over a fire to a tripod, filled the amphitheater with the odor of burnt flesh. But this man, like the real Scaevola, remained without a groan, his eyes raised and the murmur of prayer on his blackening lips. When he had expired and his body was dragged to the spoliarium, the usual midday interlude followed. Caesar with the Vestals and the Augustians left the amphitheater, and withdrew to an immense scarlet tent erected purposely. In this was prepared for him, and the guests a magnificent prandium. The spectators for the greater part followed his example, arid, streaming out, disposed themselves in picturesque groups around the tent, to rest their limbs wearied from long sitting, and enjoy the food which, through Caesar's favor, was served by slaves to them. Only the most curious descended to the arena itself, and, touching with their fingers lumps of sand held together by blood, conversed, as specialists and amateurs, of that which had happened, and of that which was to follow. Soon even these went away, lest they might be late for the feast. Only those few were left who stayed not through curiosity, but sympathy for the coming victims. Those concealed themselves behind seats or in the lower places. Meanwhile the arena was leveled, and slaves began to dig holes one near the other in rows throughout the whole circuit from side to side, so that the last row was but a few paces distant from Caesar's podium. From outside came the murmur of people, shouts and plaudits, while within they were preparing in hot haste for new tortures. The canicula were opened simultaneously, and in all passages leading to the arena were urged forward crowds of Christians naked, and carrying crosses on their shoulders. The whole arena was filled with them. Old men, bending under the weight of wooden beams, ran forward. At the sight of these went men in the prime of life, women with loosened hair behind which they strove to hide their nakedness, small boys, and little children. The crosses, for the greater part, as well as the victims, were wreathed with flowers. The servants of the amphitheater beat the unfortunates with clubs, forcing them to lay down their crosses near the holes prepared, and stand themselves there in rows. Thus were to perish those whom executioners had had no chance to drive out as food for dogs and wild beasts the first day of the games. Black slaves seized the victims, laid them face upward on the wood, and fell to nailing their hands hurriedly and quickly to the arms of the crosses, so that people returning after the interlude might find all the crosses standing. The whole amphitheater resounded with the noise of hammers which echoed through all the rows, went out to the space surrounding the amphitheater, and into the tent, where Caesar was entertaining his suite and the Vestals. There he drank wine, bantered with Chilo, and whispered strange words in the ears of the priestesses of Vesta. But on the arena the work was seething. Nails were going into the hands and feet of the Christians. Shovels moved quickly, filling the holes in which the crosses had been planted. Among the new victims whose turn was to come soon was Crispus. The lions had not had time to rend him, hence he was appointed to the cross. He, ready at all times for death, was delighted with the thought that his hour was approaching. He seemed another man, for his emaciated body was wholly naked. Only a girdle of ivy encircled his hips. On his head was a garland of roses. But in his eyes gleamed always that same exhaustless energy, that same fanatical stern face gazed from beneath the crown of roses. Neither had his heart changed. For, as once in the caniculum he had threatened with the wrath of God his brethren sewed up in the skins of wild beasts, so today he thundered in place of consoling them. "Thank the Redeemer," said Crispus, "that he permits you to die the same death that he himself died. Maybe a part of your sins will be remitted for this cause, but tremble, since justice must be satisfied, and there cannot be one reward for the just and the wicked." His words were accompanied by the sound of the hammers nailing the hands and feet of victims. Every moment more crosses were raised on the arena, but he, turning to the crowd standing each man by his own cross, continued, "One see heaven open, but I see also the yawning abyss. I know not what account of my life to give the Lord, though I have believed and hated evil. I fear not death, but resurrection. I fear not torture, but judgment, for the day of wrath is at hand." At that moment was heard from between the nearest rows some voice, calm and solemn, "Not the day of wrath, but of mercy, the day of salvation and happiness. For I say that Christ will gather you in, will comfort you, and seat you at his right hand. Be confident, for heaven is opening before you." At these words all eyes were turned to the benches. Even those who were hanging on the crosses raised their pale, tortured faces, and looked toward the man who was speaking. But he went to the barrier surrounding the arena, and blessed them with the sign of the cross. Crispus stretched out his arm, as if to thunder at him, but when he saw the man's face, he dropped his arm, the knees bent under him, and his lips whispered, Paul the Apostle. To the great astonishment of the servants of the circus, all of those who were not nailed to the crosses yet knelt down. Paul turned to Crispus and said, "Threaten them not, Crispus, for this day they will be with thee in paradise. It is thy thought that they may be condemned. But who will condemn? Will God, who gave his Son for them? Will Christ, who died for their salvation, condemn when they die for his name? And how is it possible that he who loves can condemn? Who will accuse the chosen of God? Who will say of this blood, it is cursed? I have hated evil," said the old priest. Christ's command to love men was higher than that to hate evil, for his religion is not hatred, but love. "I have sinned in the hour of death," answered Crispus, beating his breast. The manager of the seats approached the apostle and inquired, "Who art thou, speaking to the condemned?" "A Roman citizen," answered Paul, calmly. Then, turning to Crispus, he said, "Colon, be confident, for today is a day of grace. Die in peace, O servant of God." The black men approached Crispus at that moment to place him on the cross, but he looked around once again and cried, "My brethren, pray for me." His face had lost its usual sternness. His stony features had taken an expression of peace and sweetness. He stretched his arms himself along the arms of the cross to make the work easier and, looking directly into heaven, began to pray earnestly. He seemed to feel nothing, for when the nails entered his hands, not the least quiver shook his body, nor on his face did there appear any wrinkle of pain. He prayed when they raised the cross and trampled the earth around it. Only when crowds began to fill the amphitheater with shouts and laughter did his brows frown somewhat, as if in anger that a pagan people were disturbing the calm and peace of a sweet death. But all the crosses had been raised, so that in the arena there stood as it were a forest, with people hanging on the trees. On the arms and by the crosses, and on the heads of the martyrs, fell the gleam of the sun. But on the arena was a deep shadow, forming a kind of black involved grating through which glittered the golden sand. That was a spectacle in which the whole delight of the audience consisted in looking at a lingering death. Never before had men seen such a density of crosses. The arena was packed so closely that the servants squeezed between them only with effort. On the edges were women especially. But Crispus, as a leader, was raised almost in front of Caesar's podium, on an immense cross, wreathed below with honeysuckle. None of the victims had died yet, but some of those fastened earlier had fainted. No one groaned. No one called for mercy. Some were hanging with head inclined on one arm, or dropped on the breast, as if seized by sleep. Some were as if in meditation. Some, looking toward heaven, were moving their lips quietly. In this terrible forest of crosses, among those crucified bodies, in that silence of victims there was something ominous. The people who, filled by the feast and gladsome, had returned to the circus with shouts, became silent, not knowing on which body to rest their eyes, or what to think of the spectacle. The nakedness of strange female forms roused no feeling. They did not make the usual bets as to who would die first, a thing done generally when there was even the smallest number of criminals on the arena. It seemed that Caesar himself was bored, for he turned lazily and with drowsy expression to arrange his necklace. At that moment Crispus, who was hanging opposite, and who, like a man in a faint or dying, had kept his eyes closed, opened them and looked at Caesar. His face assumed an expression so pitiless, and his eyes flashed with such fire, that the Augustans whispered to one another, pointing at him with their fingers, and at last Caesar himself turned to that cross, and placed the emerald to his eye sluggishly. Perfect silence followed. The eyes of the spectators were fixed on Crispus, who strove to move his right hand, as if to tear it from the tree. After a while his breast rose, his ribs were visible, and he cried, "Matricide, woe to thee!" The Augustans, hearing this mortal insult flung at the Lord of the world in presence of thousands, did not dare to breathe. Shiloh was half dead. Caesar trembled and dropped the emerald from his fingers. The people, too, held the breath in their breasts. The voice of Crispus was heard as it rose in power throughout the amphitheater. Woe to thee, murderer of wife and brother! Woe to thee, Antichrist! The abyss is opening beneath thee, death is stretching its hands to thee, the grave is waiting for thee. Woe, living corpse, for in terror shalt thou die, and be damned to eternity. Unable to tear his hand from the cross, Crispus strained awfully. He was terrible, a living skeleton. Unbending as predestination, he shook his white beard over Nero's podium, scattering, as he nodded, rose leaves from the garland on his head. Woe to thee, murderer! Thy measure is surpassed, and thy hour is at hand. Here he made one more effort. It seemed for a moment that he would free his hand from the cross and hold it in menace above Caesar, but all at once his emaciated arms extended still more, his body settled down, his head fell on his breast, and he died. In that forest of crosses the weakest began also the sleep of eternity. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.